patient. And the evidence is so easy to check, just lying out there in front of us. It can be obtained by looking at countries that are both wealthy and have some level of education, and considering which condition preceded the other. Take the following potent and less-is-more style argument by the rogue economist Ha-Jun Chang. In 1960, Taiwan had a much lower literacy rate than the Philippines and half the income per person. Today, Taiwan has 10 times the income. At the same time, Korea had a much lower literacy rate than Argentina, which had one of the highest in the world, and about 1/5 the income per person. Today, it has 3 times as much. Further, over the same period, sub-Saharan Africa saw markedly increasing literacy rates, accompanied with a decrease in their standard of living. We can multiply the examples. Pritchett's study is quite thorough. But I wonder why people don't realize the simple truism, that is, the fooled-by-randomness effect. Mistaking the merely associative for the causal, that is, if rich countries are educated, immediately inferring that education makes a country rich, without even checking. Epiphenomenon here again. The error in reasoning is a bit from wishful thinking, because education is considered good. I wonder why people don't make the epiphenomenal association between the wealth of a country and something bad, say, decadence, and infer that decadence, or some other disease of wealth like a high suicide rate, also generates wealth. I am not saying that for an individual, education is useless. It builds helpful credentials for one's own career. But such effect washes out at the country level. Education stabilizes the income of families across generations. A merchant makes money. Then his children go to the Sorbonne. They become doctors and magistrates. The family retains wealth because the diplomas allow members to remain in the middle class long after the ancestral wealth is depleted. But these effects don't count for countries. Further, Alison Wolfe debunks the flaw in logic in going from the point that it is hard to imagine Microsoft or British Aerospace without advanced knowledge to the idea that more education means more wealth. The simple one-way relationship which so entrances our politicians and commentators, education spending in, economic growth out, simply doesn't exist. Moreover, the larger and more complex the education sector, the less obvious any links to productivity become. And, similar to Pritchett, she looks at countries such as, say, Egypt, and shows how the giant leap in education it underwent did not translate into the highly cherished golden GDP growth that makes countries important or unimportant on the ranking tables. This argument is not against adopting governmental educational policies for noble aims such as reducing inequality in the population, allowing the poor to access good literature and read Dickens, Victor Hugo, or Julian Gracz, or increasing the freedom of women in poor countries, which happens to decrease the birth rate. But then one should not use the excuses of growth or wealth in such matters. I once ran into Alison Wolfe at a party. Parties are great for optionality. As I got her to explain to other people her evidence about the lack of effectiveness of funding formal education, one person got frustrated with our skepticism. Wolfe's answer to him was, "Real education is this," pointing at the room full of people chatting. Accordingly, I am not saying that knowledge is not important. The skepticism in this discussion applies to the brand of commoditized, pre-packaged, and pink-coated knowledge, stuff one can buy in the open market and use for self-promotion. Further, let me remind the reader that scholarship and organized education are not the same. Another party story. Once at a formal fancy dinner, a fellow in a quick speech deplored the education level in the United States, falling for the kind of low math grades alarmism. Although I agreed with all his other views, I felt compelled to intervene. I interrupted him to state the point that America's values were convex risk-taking, and that I am glad that we are not like these helicopter mom cultures, the kind of thing I am writing here. Everyone was shocked, either confused or in heavy but passive disagreement, except for one person who came to lend her support to me. It turned out that she was the head of the New York City school system. Also, note that I am not saying that universities do not generate knowledge at all and do not help growth, outside, of course, of most standard economics and other superstitions that set us back. All I am saying is that their role is overly hyped up, and that their members seem to exploit some of the gullibility we have in establishing wrong causal links, mostly on superficial impressions. Polished dinner partners. Education has benefits aside from stabilizing family incomes. Education makes individuals more polished dinner partners, for instance, something non-negligible. But the idea of educating people to improve the economy is rather novel. The British government documents, as early as 50 years ago, an aim for education other than the one we have today. Raising values, making good citizens, and learning, not economic growth. They were not suckers at the time. A point also made by Alison Wolfe. Likewise, in ancient times, learning was for learning's sake, to make someone a good person worth talking to, not to increase the stock of gold in the city's heavily guarded coffers. Entrepreneurs, particularly those in technical jobs, are not necessarily the best people to have dinner with. I recall a heuristic I used in my previous profession when hiring people, called separate those who, when they go to a museum, look at the Cézanne on the wall, from those who focus on the contents of the trash can. The more interesting their conversation, the more cultured they are, the more they will be trapped into thinking that they are effective at what they are doing in real business, something psychologists call the halo effect, the mistake of thinking that skills in, say, skiing translate unfailingly into skills in managing a pottery workshop or a bank department, or that a good chess player would be a good strategist in real life. The halo effect is largely the opposite of domain dependence. Clearly, it is unrigorous to equate skills at doing with skills at talking. My experience of good practitioners is that they can be totally incomprehensible. They do not have to put much energy in turning their insights and internal coherence into elegant style and narratives. Entrepreneurs are selected to be just doers, not thinkers, and doers do, they don't talk, and it would be unfair, wrong, and downright insulting to measure them in the talk department. The same with artisans. The quality lies in their product, not their conversation. In fact, they can easily have false beliefs that, as a side effect, inverse iatrogenics, lead them to make better products. So what? Bureaucrats, on the other hand, because of the lack of an objective metric of success and the absence of market forces, are selected on the halo effects of shallow looks and elegance. The side effect is to make them better at conversation. I am quite certain a dinner with a United Nations employee would cover more interesting subjects than one with some of Fat Tony's cousins or a computer entrepreneur obsessed with circuits. Let us look deeper at this flaw in thinking. The Green Lumber Fallacy. In one of the rare non-charlatanic books in finance, descriptively called What I Learned Losing $1 Million, the protagonist makes a big discovery. He remarks that a fellow named Joe Siegel, one of the most successful traders in a commodity called green lumber, actually thought that it was lumber painted green, rather than freshly cut lumber, called green because it had not been dried. And he made it his profession to trade the stuff. Meanwhile, the narrator was into grand intellectual theories and narratives of what caused the price of commodities to move, and went bust. It is not just that the successful expert on lumber was ignorant of central matters like the designation green. He also knew things about lumber that non-experts think are unimportant. People we call ignorant might not be ignorant. The fact is that predicting the order flow in lumber and the usual narrative had little to do with the details one would assume from the outside are important. People who do things in the field are not subjected to a set exam. They are selected in the most non-narrative manner. Nice arguments don't make much difference. Evolution does not rely on narratives. Humans do. Evolution does not need a word for the color blue. So let us call the green lumber fallacy the situation in which one mistakes a source of necessary knowledge, the greenness of lumber, for another, less visible from the outside, less tractable, less narratable. My intellectual world was shattered as if everything I had studied was not just useless, but a well-organized scam, as follows. When I first became a derivatives or volatility professional, I specialized in non-linearities. I focused on exchange rates, a field in which I was embedded for several years. I had to cohabit with foreign exchange traders, people who were not involved in technical instruments as I was. Their job simply consisted of buying and selling currencies. Money changing is a very old profession with a long tradition and craft. Recall the story of Jesus Christ and the money changers. Coming to this from a highly polished Ivy League environment, I was in for a bit of a shock. You would think that the people who specialized in foreign exchange understood economics, geopolitics, mathematics, the future price of currencies, differentials between prices and countries, or that they read assiduously the economics reports published in glossy papers by various institutes. You might also imagine cosmopolitan fellows who wear ascots at the opera on Saturday night, make wine sommeliers nervous, and take tango lessons on Wednesday afternoons, or spoke intelligible English. None of that. My first day on the job was an astounding discovery of the real world. The population in foreign exchange was at the time mostly composed of New Jersey, Brooklyn, Italian fellows. Those were street, very street people, who started in the back office of banks doing wire transfers, and when the market expanded, even exploded, with the growth of commerce and the free floating of currencies, they developed into traders and became prominent in the business, and prosperous. My first conversation with an expert was with a fellow called B. something that ends with a vowel, dressed in a handmade Brioni suit. I was told that he was the biggest Swiss franc trader in the world, a legend in his day. He had predicted the big dollar collapse in the 1980s and controlled huge positions. But a short conversation with him revealed that he could not place Switzerland on the map. Foolish as I was, I thought he was Swiss-Italian. Yet he did not know there were Italian-speaking people in Switzerland. He had never been there. When I saw that he was not the exception, I started freaking out, watching all these years of education evaporating in front of my eyes. That very same day, I stopped reading economic reports. I felt nauseous for a while during this enterprise of de-intellectualization. In fact, I may not have recovered yet. If New York was blue-collar in origin, London was sub-blue-collar and even more successful. The players were entirely Cockney, even more separated from sentence-forming society. They were East Londoners, street people, extremely street, with a distinctive accent, using their own numbering system. 5 is Lady Godiva, or Ching. 15 is a Commodore. 25 is a Pony, etc. I had to learn Cockney just to communicate, and mostly to go drinking, with my colleagues during my visits there. At the time, London traders got drunk almost every day at lunch, especially on Friday, before New York opened. "Beer turns you into a lion," one fellow told me, as he hurried to finish his drink before the New York Open. The most hilarious scenes were hearing on loudspeakers transatlantic conversations between New York Bensonhurst folks and Cockney brokers, particularly when the Brooklyn fellow tried to put on a little bit of a Cockney pronunciation to be understood. These Cockneys sometimes spoke no standard English. So that is how I learned the lesson that price and reality, as seen by economists, are not the same thing. One may be a function of the other, but the function is too complex to map mathematically. The relation may have optionality in places, something that these non-sentence-savvy people knew deep inside. How Fat Tony Got Rich and Fat. Fat Tony got to become, literally, Fat Tony, rich and heavier, in the aftermath of the Kuwait War. The sequence was conventional, that is, first rich, then fat. It was in January 1991, on the day the United States attacked Baghdad to restitute Kuwait, which Iraq had invaded. Every intelligent person in socioeconomics had his theory, probabilities, scenarios, and all that, except Fat Tony. He didn't even know where Iraq was, whether it was a province in Morocco or some emirate with spicy food east of Pakistan. He didn't know the food, so the place did not exist for him. All he knew is that suckers exist. If you asked any intelligent analyst or journalist at the time, he would have predicted a rise in the price of oil in the event of war. But that causal link was precisely what Tony could not take for granted. So he bet against it. They are all prepared for a rise in oil from war, so the price must have adjusted to it. War could cause a rise in oil prices, but not scheduled war, since prices adjust to expectations. It has to be in the price, as he said. Indeed, on the news of war, oil collapsed from around $39 a barrel to almost half that value, and Tony turned his investment of $300,000 into $18 million. There are so few occasions in one's life, you can't miss them, he later told Nero during one of their lunches as he was convincing his non-New Jersey friend to bet on a collapse of the financial system. Good speculative bets come to you. You don't get them by just staying focused on the news. And note the main Fat Tony statement. Kuwait and oil are not the same thing. This will be a platform for our notion of conflation. Tony had greater upside than downside, and for him, that was it. Indeed, many people lost their shirt from the drop of oil while correctly predicting war. They just thought it was the same thing. But there had been too much hoarding, too much inventory. I remember going around that time into the office of a large fund manager who had a map of Iraq on the wall in a war room-like setting. Members of the team knew every possible thing about Kuwait, Iraq, Washington, the United Nations, except for the very simple fact that it had nothing to do with oil, not the same thing. All these analyses were nice, but not too connected to anything. Of course, the fellow got subsequently shellacked by the drop in oil price and, from what I heard, went to law school. Aside from the non-narrative view of things, another lesson. People with too much smoke and complicated tricks and methods in their brain start missing elementary, very elementary things. Persons in the real world can't afford to miss these things, otherwise they crash the plane. Unlike researchers, they were selected for survival, not complications. So I saw the less is more in action. The more studies, the less obvious, elementary, but fundamental things become. Activity, on the other hand, strips things to their simplest possible model. Conflation. Of course, so many things are not the same thing in life. Let us generalize the conflation. This lesson, not the same thing, is quite general. When you have optionality, or some anti-fragility, and can identify betting opportunities with big upside and small downside, what you do is only remotely connected to what Aristotle thinks you do. There is something, here perception, ideas, theories, and a function of something, here a price or reality, or something real. The conflation problem is to mistake one for the other, forgetting that there is a function, and that such function has different properties. Now, the more asymmetries there are between the something and the function of something, then the more difference there is between the two. They may end up having nothing to do with each other. This seems trivial, but there are big-time implications. As usual, science, not social science, but smart science, gets it. Someone who escaped the conflation problem is Jim Simons, the great mathematician who made a fortune building a huge machine to transact across markets. It replicates the buying and selling methods of these sub-blue-collar people and has more statistical significance than anyone on planet Earth. He claims to never hire economists and finance people, just physicists and mathematicians, those involved in pattern recognition accessing the internal logic of things without theorizing. Nor does he ever listen to economists or read their reports. The great economist Ariel Rubinstein gets the green lumber fallacy. It requires a great deal of intellect and honesty to see things that way. Rubinstein is one of the leaders in the field of game theory, which consists in thought experiments. He is also the greatest expert in cafes for thinking and writing across the planet. Rubinstein refuses to claim that his knowledge of theoretical matters can be translated, by him, into anything directly practical. To him, economics is like a fable. A fable writer is there to stimulate ideas, indirectly inspire practice, perhaps, but certainly not to direct or determine practice. Theory should stay independent from practice, and vice versa, and we should not extract academic economists from their campuses and put them in positions of decision-making. Economics is not a science and should not be there to advise policy. In his intellectual memoirs, Rubinstein recounts how he tried to get a Levantine vendor in the souk to apply ideas from game theory to his bargaining in place of ancestral mechanisms. The suggested method failed to produce a price acceptable to both parties. Then the fellow told him, "For generations we have bargained in our way, and you come and try to change it?" Rubinstein concluded, "I parted from him shamefaced." All we need is another two people like Rubinstein in that profession, and things will be better on planet Earth. Sometimes, even when an economic theory makes sense, its application cannot be imposed from a model in a top-down manner, so one needs the organic self-driven trial and error to get us to it. For instance, the concept of specialization that has obsessed economists since Ricardo and before blows up countries when imposed by policymakers, as it makes the economies error-prone, but it works well when reached progressively by evolutionary means, with the right buffers and layers of redundancies. Another case where economists may inspire us, but should never tell us what to do. The difference between a narrative and practice, the important things that cannot be easily narrated, lies mainly in optionality, the missed optionality of things. The right thing here is typically an anti-fragile payoff. And my argument is that you don't go to school to learn optionality, but the reverse, to become blind to it. Prometheus and Epimetheus. In Greek legend, there were two Titan brothers, Prometheus and Epimetheus. Prometheus means forethinker, while Epimetheus means afterthinker, equivalent to someone who falls for the retrospective distortion of fitting theories to past events in an ex-post narrative manner. Prometheus gave us fire and represents the progress of civilization, while Epimetheus represents backward thinking, staleness, and lack of intelligence. It was Epimetheus who accepted Pandora's gift, the large jar, with irreversible consequences. Optionality is Promethean. Narratives are Epimethean. One has reversible and benign mistakes. The other symbolizes the gravity and irreversibility of the consequences of opening Pandora's box. You make forays into the future by opportunism and optionality. So far in Book 4, we have seen the power of optionality as an alternative way of doing things, opportunistically, with some large edge to them coming from asymmetry with large benefits and benign harm. It is a way, the only way, to domesticate uncertainty, to work rationally without understanding the future, while reliance on narratives is the exact opposite. One is domesticated by uncertainty and, ironically, set back. You cannot look at the future by naive projection of the past. This brings us to the difference between doing and thinking. The point is hard to understand from the vantage point of intellectuals. As Yogi Berra said, in theory, there is no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. So far, we have seen arguments that intellect is associated with fragility and instills methods that conflict with tinkering. So far, we saw the option as the expression of anti-fragility. We separated knowledge into two categories, the formal and the fat-tony-ish, heavily grounded in the anti-fragility of trial and error and risk-taking, with less downside, barbell style, a de-intellectualized form of risk-taking, or rather, intellectual in its own way. In an opaque world, that is the only way to go. Table 4 summarizes the different aspects of the opposition between narrating and tinkering, the subject of the next three chapters. Table 4. The difference between the teleological and optionality. Narrative knowledge hates uncertainty, is fragile to change or turkey-style misunderstanding of the past. Anti-fragile, optionality-driven tinkering, trial and error, domesticates uncertainty, is anti-fragile to the unknown. Narrative knowledge looks at the past, subject to overfitting to the past. Optionality looks at the future. Narrative knowledge is like Epimetheus. Optionality is like Prometheus. Narrative knowledge involves teleological action. Optionality involves opportunistic action. Narrative knowledge is tourist style. Optionality is flaneur style. Narrative knowledge is fragile, naive rationality. Optionality is robust rationality. Narrative knowledge is psychologically comfortable. Optionality is psychologically uncomfortable, but has a sense of thrill and adventure. Narrative knowledge is concave, visible known gains, unknown errors. Optionality is convex, small known errors, large possible gains. Narrative knowledge is subjected to turkey problems, mistaking evidence of absence for absence of evidence. Optionality can benefit from suckers and turkey problems. Narrative knowledge is subjected to epiphenomena and the green lumber fallacy. Optionality escapes the green lumber fallacy. Narrative knowledge is academia's sole mechanism outside laboratory and physical science. Optionality is practice's main mechanism. Narrative knowledge's narrative is epistemological. Optionality's narrative is instrumental. Narrative knowledge is trapped into a story. Optionality has no meaningful dependence on a story. The narrative can be just for motivation. Narrative knowledge has a narrow domain, closed space of action. Optionality has a broad domain, open space of action. Narrative knowledge needs to understand the logic of things. With optionality, little understanding is necessary, just rationality in comparing two outcomes, exercising the better option. Narrative knowledge doesn't benefit from the philosopher's stone, aka convexity bias, see chapter 19. Optionality relies on the philosopher's stone. All this does not mean that tinkering and trial and error are devoid of narrative. They are just not overly dependent on the narrative being true. The narrative is not epistemological, but instrumental. For instance, religious stories might have no value as narratives, but they may get you to do something convex and anti-fragile you otherwise would not do, like mitigate risks. English parents controlled children with the false narrative that if they didn't behave or eat their dinner, Boney, Napoleon Bonaparte, or some wild animal might come and take them away. Religions often use the equivalent method to help adults get out of trouble or avoid debt. But intellectuals tend to believe their own bullshit and take their ideas too literally, and that is vastly dangerous. Consider the role of heuristic rule-of-thumb knowledge embedded in traditions. Simply, just as evolution operates on individuals, so does it act on these tacit, unexplainable rules of thumb transmitted through generations, what Karl Popper has called evolutionary epistemology. But let me change Popper's idea ever so slightly, actually quite a bit. My take is that this evolution is not a competition between ideas, but between humans and systems based on such ideas. An idea does not survive because it is better than the competition, but rather because the person who holds it has survived. Accordingly, wisdom you learn from your grandmother should be vastly superior, empirically, hence scientifically, to what you get from a class in business school, and of course, considerably cheaper. My sadness is that we have been moving farther and farther away from grandmothers. Expert problems, in which the expert knows a lot, but less than he thinks he does, often bring fragilities and acceptance of ignorance the reverse. Expert problems put you on the wrong side of asymmetry. Let us examine the point with respect to risk. When you are fragile, you need to know a lot more than when you are anti-fragile. Conversely, when you think you know more than you do, you are fragile to error. We showed earlier the evidence that classroom education does not lead to wealth as much as it comes from wealth, an epiphenomenon. Next, let us see how, similarly, anti-fragile risk-taking, not education and formal organized research, is largely responsible for innovation and growth, while the story is dressed up by textbook writers. It does not mean that theories and research play no role. It is that just as we are fooled by randomness, so we are fooled into overestimating the role of well-sounding ideas. We will look at the confabulations committed by historians of economic thought, medicine, technology, and other fields that tend to systematically downgrade practitioners and fall into the green lumber fallacy. Chapter 15. Rewriting the History of Technology. How, in science, history is rewritten by the losers, and how I saw it in my own business, and how we can generalize. Does knowledge of biology hurt medicine? Hiding the role of luck. What makes a good entrepreneur? History written by the losers. The birds may perhaps listen. Combining stupidity with wisdom rather than the opposite. Where we look for the arrow of discovery. A vindication of trial and error. Because of a spate of biases, historians are prone to epiphenomena and other illusions of cause and effect. To understand the history of technology, you need accounts by non-historians, or historians with the right frame of mind, who develop their ideas by watching the formation of technologies, instead of just reading accounts concerning it. I mentioned earlier Terence Keeley's debunking of the so-called linear model, and that he was a practicing scientist. A practicing laboratory scientist or an engineer can witness the real-life production of, say, pharmacological innovations or the jet engine, and can thus avoid falling for epiphenomena, unless he was brainwashed prior to starting practice. I have seen evidence, as an eyewitness, of results that owe nothing to academizing science, rather evolutionary tinkering that was dressed up and claimed to have come from academia. Table 5. The lecturing birds how to fly effect across domains. Example of misattribution of results in textbooks. The origination of the jet engine is marketed as physicists, busted by Scranton, but it actually came from tinkering engineers with no understanding of why it works. The origination of architecture is marketed as Euclidean geometry and mathematics, busted by Bourgeois. But it actually came from heuristics and secret recipes, guilds. The origination of cybernetics is marketed as Norbert Wiener, busted by Mendel. But it actually came from programmers, wiki-style. The origination of derivatives formulas is marketed as Black, Scholes, and Fragilista Merton, busted by Haug and Taleb. But it actually came from traders and practitioners, Raynaud, Bachelier, Thorpe. The origination of medicine is marketed as biological understanding, busted by a long series of doctors. But it actually came from luck, trial and error, side effects of other medicines, or sometimes poisoning, mustard gas. The origination of the Industrial Revolution is marketed as growth in knowledge, scientific revolution, busted by Keeley. But it actually came from adventurers and hobbyists. The origination of technology is marketed as formal science, but it actually came from technology and businesses. Long before I knew the results in Table 5 of other scholars debunking the lecturing birds how to fly effect, the problem started screaming at me as follows around 1998. I was sitting in a Chicago restaurant with the late Fred A., an economist, though a true, thoughtful gentleman. He was the chief economist of one of the local exchanges and had to advise them on new, complicated financial products and wanted my opinion on these, as I specialized in and had published a textbook of sorts on the so-called very complicated exotic options. He recognized that the demand for these products was going to be very large, but he wondered how traders could handle these complicated exotics if they did not understand the Gersonoff theorem. The Gersonoff theorem is something mathematically complicated that at the time was only known by a very small number of persons. And we were talking about pit traders who, as we saw in the last chapter, would most certainly mistake Gersonoff for a vodka brand. Traders, usually uneducated, were considered overeducated if they could spell their street address correctly, while the professor was truly under the epiphenomenal impression that traders studied mathematics to produce an option price. I for myself had figured out by trial and error and picking the brains of experienced people how to play with these complicated payoffs before I heard of these theorems. Something hit me then. Nobody worries that a child ignorant of the various theorems of aerodynamics and incapable of solving an equation of motion would be unable to ride a bicycle. So why didn't he transfer the point from one domain to another? Didn't he realize that these Chicago pit traders respond to supply and demand, little more, in competing to make a buck, with no need for the Gersonov theorem, any more than a trader of pistachios in the souk of Damascus needs to solve general equilibrium equations to set the price of his product? For a minute, I wondered if I was living on another planet, or if the gentleman's Ph.D. in research career had led to this blindness and his strange loss of common sense, or if people without practical sense usually managed to get the energy and interest to acquire a Ph.D. in the fictional world of equation economics. Is there a selection bias? I smelled a rat and got extremely excited, but realized that for someone to be able to help me, he had to be both a practitioner and a researcher, with practice coming before research. I knew of only one other person, a trader turned researcher, Espen Haug, who had to have observed the same mechanism. Like me, he got his doctorate after spending time in trading rooms. So we immediately embarked on an investigation about the source of the option pricing formula that we were using. What did people use before? Is it thanks to the academically derived formula that we are able to operate? Or did the formula come through some anti-fragile evolutionary discovery process based on trial and error, now expropriated by academics? I already had a hint as I had worked as a pit trader in Chicago and had observed veteran traders who refused to touch mathematical formulas, using simple heuristics and saying real men don't use sheets, the sheets being the printouts of output from the complex formulas that came out of computers. Yet these people had survived. Their prices were sophisticated and more efficient than those produced by the formula, and it was obvious what came first. For instance, the prices accounted for extremiston and fat tails, which the standard formulas ignored. Haug has some interests that diverge from mine. He was into the subject of finance and eager to collect historical papers by practitioners. He called himself the collector, even used it as a signature, as he went to assemble and collect books and articles on option theory written before the Great War, and from there we built a very precise image of what had taken place. To our great excitement, we had proof after proof that traders had vastly, vastly more sophistication than the formula. And their sophistication preceded the formula by at least a century. It was, of course, picked up through natural selection, survivorship, apprenticeship to experienced practitioners, and one's own experience. Traders trade. Then traders figure out techniques and products. Then academic economists find formulas and claim traders are using them. Then new traders believe academics. Then blow-ups from theory-induced fragility. Our paper sat for close to 7 years before publication by an academic economics journal. Until then, a strange phenomenon. It became one of the most downloaded papers in the history of economics, but was not cited at all during its first few years. Nobody wanted to stir the pot. Practitioners don't write. They do. Birds fly, and those who lecture them are the ones who write their story. So it is easy to see that history is truly written by losers with time on their hands and a protected academic position. The greatest irony is that we watched firsthand how narratives of thought are made, as we were lucky enough to face another episode of blatant intellectual expropriation. We received an invitation to publish our side of the story, being option practitioners, in the Honorable Wiley Encyclopedia of Quantitative Finance. So we wrote a version of the previous paper, mixed with our own experiences. Shock. We caught the editor of the historical section, one Barnard College professor, red-handed trying to modify our account. A historian of economic thought, he proceeded to rewrite our story to play down, if not reverse, its message and change the arrow of the formation of knowledge. This was scientific history in the making. The fellow sitting in his office in Barnard College was now dictating to us what we saw as traitors. We were supposed to override what we saw with our own eyes, with his logic. I came to notice a few similar inversions of the formation of knowledge. For instance, in his book written in the late 1990s, the Berkeley professor, highly certified fragilista Mark Rubenstein, attributed to publications by finance professors techniques and heuristics that we practitioners had been extremely familiar with, often in more sophisticated forms, since the 1980s, when I got involved in the business. No, we don't put theories into practice. We create theories out of practice. That was our story, and it is easy to infer from it, and from similar stories, that the confusion is generalized. The theory is the child of the cure, not the opposite. Ex cura teoria nascitur. The evidence staring at us. It turned out that engineers, too, get sandbagged by historians. Right after the previous nauseating episode, I presented the joint paper I had written with Haug on the idea of lecturing birds on how to fly in finance at the London School of Economics in their Sociology of Science seminar. I was, of course, heckled, but was by then very well trained at being heckled by economists. Then, surprise. At the conclusion of the session, the organizers informed me that, exactly a week earlier, Phil Scranton, a professor from Rutgers, had delivered the exact same story. But it was not about the option formula, it was about the jet engine. Scranton showed that we have been building and using jet engines in a completely trial-and-error experiential manner, without anyone truly understanding the theory. Builders needed the original engineers who knew how to twist things to make the engine work. Theory came later, in a lame way, to satisfy the intellectual bean counter. But that's not what you tend to read in standard histories of technology. My son, who studies aerospace engineering, was not aware of this. Scranton was polite and focused on situations in which innovation is messy, distinguished from more familiar analytic and synthetic innovation approaches, as if the latter were the norm, which it is obviously not. I looked for more stories, and the historian of technology David Edgerton presented me with a quite shocking one. We think of cybernetics, which led to the cyber in cyberspace, as invented by Norbert Wiener in 1948. The historian of engineering David Mindell debunked the story. He showed that Wiener was articulating ideas about feedback control and digital computing that had long been in practice in the engineering world. Yet people, even today's engineers, have the illusion that we owe the field to Wiener's mathematical thinking. Then I was hit with the following idea. We all learn geometry from textbooks based on axioms, like, say, Euclid's Book of Elements, and tend to think that it is thanks to such learning that we today have these beautiful geometric shapes in buildings, from houses to cathedrals. To think the opposite would be anathema. So I speculated immediately that the ancients developed an interest in Euclid's geometry and other mathematics because they were already using these methods, derived by tinkering and experiential knowledge. Otherwise, they would not have bothered at all. This is similar to the story of the wheel. Recall that the steam engine had been discovered and developed by the Greeks some 2 millennia before the Industrial Revolution. It is just that things that are implemented tend to want to be born from practice, not theory. Now take a look at architectural objects around us. They appear so geometrically sophisticated, from the pyramids to the beautiful cathedrals of Europe. So a sucker problem would make us tend to believe that mathematics led to these beautiful objects, with exceptions here and there, such as the pyramids, as these preceded the more formal mathematics we had after Euclid and other Greek theorists. Some facts. Architects, or what were then called masters of works, relied on heuristics, empirical methods, and tools, and almost nobody knew any mathematics. According to the medieval science historian Guy Baujouan, before the 13th century, no more than 5 persons in the whole of Europe knew how to perform a division. No theorem schmearum. But builders could figure out the resistance of materials without the equations we have today. Buildings that are, for the most part, still standing. The 13th-century French architect Villard d'Ancourt documents with his series of drawings and notebooks in Picard, the language of the Picardy region in France, how cathedrals were built. Experimental heuristics, small tricks, and rules, later tabulated by Philibert Delorme in his architectural treatises. For instance, a triangle was visualized as the head of a horse. Experimentation can make people much more careful than theories. Further, we are quite certain that the Romans, admirable engineers, built aqueducts without mathematics. Roman numerals did not make quantitative analysis very easy. Otherwise, I believe, these would not be here, as a patent side effect of mathematics is making people over-optimize and cut corners, causing fragility. Just look how the new is increasingly more perishable than the old. And take a look at Vitruvius's manual, De Architectura, the Bible of architects, written about 300 years after Euclid's Elements. There is little formal geometry in it, and, of course, no mention of Euclid, mostly heuristics, the kind of knowledge that comes out of a master guiding his apprentices. Tellingly, the main mathematical result he mentions is Pythagoras's theorem, amazed that the right angle could be formed without the contrivances of the artisan. Mathematics had to have been limited to mental puzzles until the Renaissance. Now, I am not saying that theories or academic science are not behind some practical technologies at all, directly derived from science for their final use, not for some tangential use. What the researcher Joel Mocher calls an epistemic base, or propositional knowledge, a sort of repository of formal knowledge that embeds the theoretical and empirical discoveries and becomes a rulebook of sorts, used to generate more knowledge and, he thinks, more applications. In other words, a body of theories from which further theories can be directly derived. But let's not be suckers. Following Mr. Mocher would make one want to study economic geography to predict foreign exchange prices. I would have loved to introduce him to the expert in green lumber. While I accept the notion of epistemic base, what I question is the role it has really played in the history of technology. The evidence of a strong effect is not there, and I am waiting for someone to show it to me. Mocher and the advocates of such view provide no evidence that it is not epiphenomenal, nor do they appear to understand the implications of asymmetric effects. Where is the role of optionality in this? There is a body of know-how that was transmitted from master to apprentice, and transmitted only in such a manner, with degrees necessary as a selection process, or to make the profession more respectable, or to help here and there, but not systematically. And the role of such formal knowledge will be overappreciated precisely because it is highly visible. Is it like cooking? Cooking seems to be the perfect business that depends on optionality. You add an ingredient and have the option of keeping the result if it is in agreement with Fat Tony's taste buds, or forget about it if it's not. We also have wiki-style collaborative experimentation, leading to a certain body of recipes. These recipes are derived entirely without conjectures about the chemistry of taste buds, with no role for any epistemic base to generate theories out of theories. Nobody is fooled so far by the process. As Dan Ariely once observed, we cannot reverse engineer the taste of food from looking at the nutritional label, and we can observe ancestral heuristics at work. Generations of collective tinkering resulting in the evolution of recipes. These food recipes are embedded in cultures. Cooking schools are entirely apprenticeship-based. On the other side, we have pure physics, with theories used to generate theories with some empirical validation. There, the epistemic base can play a role. The discovery of the Higgs boson is a modern case of a particle entirely expected from theoretical derivations. So was Einstein's relativity. Prior to the Higgs boson, one spectacular case of a discovery with a small number of existing external data is that of the French astronomer Le Verrier's derivation of the existence of the planet Neptune. He did that on the basis of solitary computation from the behavior of the surrounding planets. When the planet was actually sighted, he refused to look at it, so comfortable was he with his result. These are exceptions, and tend to take place in physics and other places I call linear, where errors are from mediocristan, not from extremistan. Now, use this idea of cooking as a platform to grasp other pursuits. Do other activities resemble it? If we put technologies through scrutiny, we would see that most do, in fact, resemble cooking a lot more than physics, particularly those in the complex domain. Even medicine today remains an apprenticeship model with some theoretical science in the background, but made to look entirely like science. And if it leaves the apprenticeship model, it would be for the evidence-based method that relies less on biological theories and more on the cataloging of empirical regularities, the phenomenology I explained in Chapter 7. Why is it that science comes and goes and technologies remain stable? Now, one can see a possible role for basic science, but not in the way it is intended to be. For an example of a chain of unintended uses, let us start with Phase 1, the computer. The mathematical discipline of combinatorics, here basic science, derived from propositional knowledge, led to the building of computers, or so the story goes. And of course, to remind the reader of cherry-picking, we need to take into account the body of theoretical knowledge that went nowhere. But at first, nobody had an idea what to do with these enormous boxes full of circuits, as they were cumbersome, expensive, and their applications were not too widespread, outside of database management, only good to process quantities of data. It is as if one needed to invent an application for the thrill of technology. Baby boomers will remember those mysterious punch cards. Then someone introduced the console to input with the aid of a screen monitor, using a keyboard. This led, of course, to word processing, and the computer took off because of its fitness to word processing, particularly with the microcomputer in the early 1980s. It was convenient, but not much more than that until some other unintended consequence came to be mixed into it. Now phase two, the Internet. It had been set up as a resilient military communication network device, developed by a research unit of the Department of Defense called DARPA, and got a boost the days when Ronald Reagan was obsessed with the Soviets. It was meant to allow the United States to survive a generalized military attack. Great idea, but add the personal computer plus internet and we get social networks, broken marriages, a rise in nerdiness, the ability for a post-Soviet person with social difficulties to find a matching spouse. All that thanks to U.S. tax dollars, or rather budget deficit, during Reagan's anti-Soviet crusade. So for now, we are looking at the forward arrow, and at no point, although science was at some use along the way, since computer technology relies on science in most of its aspects, at no point did academic science serve in setting its direction. Rather, it served as a slave to chance discoveries in an opaque environment, with almost no one but college dropouts and overgrown high school students along the way. The process remained self-directed and unpredictable at every step. And the great fallacy is to make it sound irrational. The irrational resides in not seeing a free option when it is handed to us. China might be a quite convincing story, through the works of a genius observer, Joseph Needham, who debunked quite a bit of Western beliefs and figured out the powers of Chinese science. As China became a top-down mandarinate, that is, a state managed by Soviet Harvard centralized scribes, as Egypt had been before, the players somehow lost the zest for bricolage, the hunger for trial and error. Needham's biographer Simon Winchester cites the sinologist Mark Elvin's description of the problem, as the Chinese did not have, or rather no longer had, what he called the European mania for tinkering and improving. They had all the means to develop a spinning machine, but nobody tried. Another example of knowledge hampering optionality. They probably needed someone like Steve Jobs, blessed with an absence of college education and the right aggressiveness of temperament, to take the elements to their natural conclusion. As we will see in the next section, it is precisely this type of uninhibited doer who made the Industrial Revolution happen. We will next examine two cases, first, the Industrial Revolution, and second, medicine. So let us start by debunking a causal myth about the Industrial Revolution, the overstatement of the role of science in it. The Industrial Revolution. Knowledge formation, even when theoretical, takes time, some boredom, and the freedom that comes from having another occupation, therefore allowing one to escape the journalistic-style pressure of modern publish-and-perish academia to produce cosmetic knowledge, much like the counterfeit watches one buys in Chinatown in New York City, the type that you know is counterfeit, although it looks like the real thing. There were two main sources of technical knowledge and innovation in the 19th and early 20th centuries, the hobbyist and the English rector, both of whom were generally in barbell situations. An extraordinary proportion of work came out of the rector, the English parish priest with no worries, erudition, a large or at least comfortable house, domestic help, a reliable supply of tea and scones with clotted cream, and an abundance of free time. And, of course, optionality. The enlightened amateur, that is. The Reverend Thomas Bayes, as in Bayesian probability, and Thomas Malthus, Malthusian overpopulation, are the most famous. But there are many more surprises, cataloged in Bill Bryson's home, in which the author found 10 times more vicars and clergymen leaving recorded traces for posterity than scientists, physicists, economists, and even inventors. In addition to the previous 2 giants, I randomly list contributions by country clergymen. Reverend Edmund Cartwright invented the power loom, contributing to the Industrial Revolution. Reverend Jack Russell bred the terrier. Reverend William Buckland was the first authority on dinosaurs. Reverend William Greenwell invented modern archaeology. Reverend Octavius Pickard Cambridge was the foremost authority on spiders. Reverend George Garrett invented the submarine. Reverend Gilbert White was the most esteemed naturalist of his day. Reverend M.J. Barclay was the top expert on fungi. Reverend John Michel helped discover Uranus, and many more. Note that, just as with our episode documented with Haug, that organized science tends to skip the not made here, so the list of visible contribution by hobbyists and doers is most certainly shorter than the real one, as some academic might have appropriated the innovation by his predecessor. Let me get poetic for a moment. Self-directed scholarship has an aesthetic dimension. For a long time, I had on the wall of my study the following quote by Jacques Le Goff, the great French medievalist who believes that the Renaissance came out of independent humanists, not professional scholars. He examined the striking contrast in period paintings, drawings, and renditions that compare medieval university members and humanists. One is a professor surrounded and besieged by huddled students. The other is a solitary scholar, sitting in the tranquility and privacy of his chambers, at ease in the spacious and comfy room where his thoughts can move freely. Here we encounter the tumult of schools, the dust of classrooms, the indifference to beauty in collective workplaces. There, it is all order and beauty, lux calm et volupte. As to the hobbyist in general, evidence shows him, along with the hungry adventurer and the private investor, to be at the source of the Industrial Revolution. Keeley, who we mentioned was not a historian and thankfully not an economist, in The Economic Laws of Scientific Research, questions the conventional linear model, that is, the belief that academic science leads to technology. For him, universities prospered as a consequence of national wealth, not the other way around. He even went further and claimed that, like naive interventions, these had iatrogenics that provided a negative contribution. He showed that in countries in which the government intervened by funding research with tax money, private investment decreased and moved away. For instance, in Japan, the almighty MITI, Ministry for Technology and Investment, has a horrible record of investment. I am not using his ideas to prop up a political program against science funding, only to debunk causal arrows in the discovery of important things. The Industrial Revolution, for a refresher, came from technologists building technology, or what he calls hobby science. Take again the steam engine, the one artifact that more than anything else embodies the Industrial Revolution. As we saw, we had a blueprint of how to build it from Hero of Alexandria. Yet, the theory didn't interest anyone for about 2 millennia. So practice and rediscovery had to be the cause of the interest in Hero's blueprint, not the other way around. Keeley presents a convincing, very convincing argument that the steam engine emerged from pre-existing technology and was created by uneducated, often isolated men who applied practical common sense and intuition to address the mechanical problems that beset them, and whose solutions would yield obvious economic reward. Now, second, consider textile technologies. Again, the main technologies that led to the jump into the modern world owe, according to Keeley, nothing to science. In 1733, he writes, John Kay invented the flying shuttle, which mechanized weaving, and in 1770, James Hargreaves invented the spinning jenny, which, as its name implies, mechanized spinning. These major developments in textile technology, as well as those of Wyatt and Paul, spinning frame, 1758, Arkwright, water frame, 1769, presaged the Industrial Revolution. Yet they owed nothing to science. They were empirical developments based on the trial, error, and experimentation of skilled craftsmen who were trying to improve the productivity and so the profits of their factories. David Edgerton did some work questioning the link between academic science and economic prosperity, along with the idea that people believed in the linear model, that is, that academic science was at the source of technology, in the past. People were no suckers in the 19th and 20th century. We believe today that they believed in the said linear model then, but they did not. In fact, academics were mostly just teachers, not researchers, until well into the 20th century. Now, instead of looking into a scholar's writings to see whether he is credible or not, it is always best to consider what his detractors say. They will uncover what's worst in his argument. So I looked for the detractors of Keeley, or people opposing his ideas, to see if they address anything of merit, and to see where they come from. Aside from some comments by Joel Moker, who, as I said, has not yet discovered optionality, and an attack by an economist of the type who don't count, given the devaluation of the currency of the economics profession, the main critique against Keeley, published in the influential journal Nature by a science bureaucrat, was that he uses data from government-sponsored agencies, such as the OECD, in his argument against tax-funded research. So far, no substantive evidence that Keeley was wrong. But let us flip the burden of evidence. There is zero evidence that the opposite of his thesis is remotely right. Much of all of this is a religious belief in the unconditional power of organized science, one that has replaced unconditional religious belief in organized religion. Governments should spend on non-teleological tinkering, not research. Note that I do not believe that the argument set forth above should logically lead us to say that no money should be spent by government. This reasoning is more against teleology than research in general. There has to be a form of spending that works. By some vicious turn of events, governments have gotten huge payoffs from research, but not as intended. Just consider the Internet. And look at the recapture we've had of military expenditures with innovations, and, as we will see, medical cures. It is just that functionaries are too teleological in the way they look for things, particularly the Japanese, and so are large corporations. Most large corporations, such as Big Pharma, are their own enemies. Consider blue sky research, whereby research grants and funding are given to people, not projects, and spread in small amounts across many researchers. The sociologist of science, Steve Shapin, who spent time in California observing venture capitalists, reports that investors tend to back entrepreneurs, not ideas. Decisions are largely a matter of opinion strengthened with who you know and who said what, as, to use the venture capitalist lingo, you bet on the jockey, not the horse. Why? Because innovations drift, and one needs flaneur-like abilities to keep capturing the opportunities that arise, not stay locked up in a bureaucratic mold. The significant venture capital decisions, Shapin showed, were made without real business plans. So if there was any analysis, it had to be of a backup, confirmatory nature. I myself spent some time with venture capitalists in California, with an eye on investing myself. And sure enough, that was the mold. Visibly, the money should go to the tinkerers, the aggressive tinkerers who you trust will milk the option. Let us use statistical arguments and get technical for a paragraph. Payoffs from research are from extremistan. They follow a power law type of statistical distribution with big, near unlimited upside, but, because of optionality, limited downside. Consequently, payoff from research should necessarily be linear to number of trials, not total funds involved in the trials. Since the winner will have an explosive payoff, uncapped, the right approach requires a certain style of blind funding. It means the right policy would be what is called the 1 divided by N or 1 over N style, spreading attempts in as large a number of trials as possible. If you face N options, invest in all of them in equal amounts. Small amounts per trial, lots of trials, broader than you want. Why? Because in extremistan, it is more important to be in something in a small amount than to miss it. As one venture capitalist told me, the payoff can be so large that you can't afford not to be in everything. The case in medicine. Unlike technology, medicine has a long history of domestication of luck. It now has accepted randomness in its practice, but not quite. Medical data allow us to assess the performance of teleological research compared to randomly generated discoveries. The U.S. government provides us with the ideal data set for that, the activities of the National Cancer Institute that came out of the Nixon War on Cancer in the early 1970s. Morton Myers, a practicing doctor and researcher,